Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is Ron's Amazing Stories. We have stories that should thrill you a little and chill you a little.
It's amazing.
You will hear adventures sent in by you guys, classic stories from the pulp mags, and episodes from the golden age of radio. We have special segments like Ghost Stories with Sylvia.
That's amazing.
And the paranormal with Jason.
I think we're going to have a lot of fun.
So settle in for the next hour and enjoy the show. Oh, and you just might want to prepare yourself to be taken away from today.
Another 5-minute mystery.
This 5-minute mystery is being brought to you by the public telephone. It is typically a coin-operated phone, often located in a telephone booth or high-traffic outdoor areas, with prepayment by inserting actual money into it. And yes, this truly does relate to our story.
Captain Randall, good afternoon. Mr. Randall, just a moment, please.
Randall speaking.
Hello, Jim. This is Tony, Mary's brother.
Well, Tony, my boy, how are you?
All fine as silk. Just flew in from Cleveland for the big race at Diamond Track.
Welcome to New York. Where are you now, Tony?
Down at the track. Thought we could drive out to your home tonight and surprise my sister. I haven't seen her in a couple of years.
That's swell. Give me a call when you get back in the city and we'll drive out together. Mary will be thrilled.
Be sure not to tell her I'm in town. I want to surprise her.
Okay, Tony. See you later. Here we are, Tony.
Hey, your place looks swell, John. You've done a lot of work on it since I was last here.
Yes, Mary and I have worked hard on this property. I can't wait to see Mary's face when she sees you.
He's a good eye.
Mary! Hello, Mary! Darling, where are you?
Maybe she went out to the store, a friend's house.
Well, not Mary. She makes a point of being here when I get home. Or else she tells me where she'll be.
You're a lucky guy.
I'll say. Hello, Mary! I'll appear in the sitting room. Mary! Mary!
Hold it, John. There's nothing we can do. She's dead. John, you've got to pull yourself together. The inspector will be here any minute.
Pour me a drink, will you, Tony? I'll be all right, I guess. I'll go. Inspector?
Yes, Inspector Abbott.
Come in, Mr. Abbott. I'm John Randall. This is my wife's brother, Anthony Marin.
Inspector. How do you do? I'm sorry about your wife, Mr. Randall.
Thanks, Inspector.
I don't want to seem cold-blooded, Mr. Randall, but we may as well begin the investigation.
Well, my wife's in here, Inspector.
Not a pretty sight. One bullet through the left temple. No sign of a struggle. Your wife must have been resting, which gave the murderer a perfect opportunity. I should say she's been dead for at least 3 hours.
Did the end come quickly, Inspector?
Yes, I'm sure she never knew a thing. Where were you, Mr. Randall, this afternoon around 3 o'clock?
At the Midston building where I work. I made one business call over on the east side, had an appointment at 2:30. I took about an hour.
I see. And you, Mr. Marin?
I flew in from Cleveland this morning. Arrived at about 1:30 and went straight to the Diamond Racetrack.
Yes, Inspector. Tony called me from the track shortly before I left the office.
I can't believe that Mary's gone. Who could have wanted to murder her?
I haven't had the time to figure out the reason why. But I know who did the murder.
Inspector Abbott, you mean that...
I mean that Anthony Marin murdered his own sister.
What was the clue that led Inspector Abbott to accuse Tony Marin of murder? In a moment, the inspector will tell you, but first...
What was the clue? What was the story? Why are these people in our tale with no idea of why, how, or even when? And they expect us to solve this one? The only clue we have is that a woman is dead. Now, unless you're a better detective than me, I'm going with... I have no freaking idea. I guess we'll just head back and probably hear what happened. But I wouldn't count on it.
Now, back to our story.
Mr. Marin became an immediate suspect when he telephoned you, Mr. Randall, from the Diamond Racetrack. It is ironic, indeed, that you had advance knowledge of his mistake. Perhaps murder could have been avoided had you known that at racetracks there are no public telephones.
Oh my gosh, no public telephones? Are you kidding me? Come on, now that has to be the lamest, worst, and most unbelievable five-minute mystery yet. No public phones? Oh, this five-minute mystery was brought to you by the public telephone. They're all but gone now. Welcome to the podcast. On the show today, it's all about the stainless steel rat. The character was introduced in Harry Harrison's short story, The Misplaced Battleship, first published in 1960 in Astounding Magazine. Harry used this story, with some minor modifications, as the introduction to the series' first full-length novel called The Stainless Steel Rat.
Why are you telling us this?
Well, because, like I said, the whole show is about the guy.
Well, okay then.
Let's just move on. Last Friday, we introduced the blog version of These Are Your Stories. It quickly became apparent to me that Friday is not a good day to publish.
You should have known better.
You're right. Not many of you took advantage of this. Of course, the post is still there and is titled, These Are Your Stories, Number 1. Just head to ronsamazingstories.blog and check it out. Now, what is this project? While it's starting out as blog posts only, for now, plans are in the work for a brand new podcast by the same name. This is going to be a live call-in show. I'm going to host it, and you guys will call in with your stories. Right now, I'm working on the logistics and will be doing some test runs, which will be posted as blogs. Once we're stable, we just might have a brand new podcast called RAS, These Are Your Stories. What I'm looking for right now are folks who would like to be part of the testing process. If you want to be a guinea pig, please let me know by heading to the main website and using the contact tab. All manners of stories are welcome, so please consider taking part. Two people have signed up so far, and I hope that there are a lot more of you. One last thing about These Are Your Stories. I like to learn from my mistakes, so it will be moving to Tuesdays. That means that there won't be a new post until November 24th. How about that? The 2020 Halloween contest has ended, and Sylvia has picked two winners this year. You two will be hearing from Sylvia soon, and we will announce these lucky folks in early December. Thank you to everyone that sent in their guests.
Ron, are we going to get to this stainless steel rat guy?
Yep, British guy. Let's do it right now. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/Ron's Amazing Stories. They have over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, computer, Kindle. Whatever you have, you can listen to Audible on it. So what am I listening to right now? The Stainless Steel Rat by Harry Harrison and narrated by Phil Gigante. DeGris is caught up in one of his crimes and recruited into the Special Corps. Boring routine desk work during his probationary period results. After an amazing discovery, the powers that be put the master thief into action and the Stainless Steel Rat is born. Here is a clip from early in the book.
It had been one of the nicest little rackets I had ever managed. For a small capital outlay, I had rented the warehouse that backed onto the government warehouse. A simple hole in the wall, and I had access to the entire stock of stored goods. Long-term supplies that I knew would be untouched for months or years in a warehouse this size. Untouched, that is, until I came along. After the hole had been made and the belt installed, it was just a matter of business. I hired the robots to remove the old labels and substitute the colorful ones I had printed. Then I marketed my goods in a strictly legal fashion. My stock was the best, and due to my imaginative operation, my costs were very low. I could afford to undersell my competitors and still make a handsome profit. The local wholesalers had been quick to sense a bargain, and I had orders for months ahead. It had been a good operation, and could have gone on for quite a while. I stifled that train of thought before it started. One lesson that has to be remembered in my line of business is that when an operation is over, it is over. The temptation to stay just one more day or to cash just one more check can be almost overwhelming. Ah, how well I know. I also know that it is also the best way to get better acquainted with the police. Turn your back and walk away and live to graft another day. That's my motto, and it's a good one. I got where I am because I stuck to it. And daydreams aren't part of getting away from the police. I pushed all thoughts from my mind as I reached the end of the aisle. The entire area outside must have been swarming with cops by this time, and I had to move fast and make no mistakes. A fast look right and left. Nobody in sight. Two steps ahead and pressed the elevator button. I had put a meter on this back elevator, and it showed that the thing was used once a month on the average. It arrived in about 3 seconds, empty, and I jumped in, thumbing the roof button at the same time. The ride seemed to go on forever, but that was just subjective. By the record, it was exactly 14 seconds. This was the most dangerous part of the trip. I tightened up as the elevator slowed. My 75 caliber recoilless was in my hand. That would take care of one cop, but no more. The door shuffled open and I relaxed. Nothing. They must have the entire area covered on the ground, so they hadn't bothered to put cops on the roof. In the open air now, I could hear the sirens for the first time. A wonderful sound. They must have had half of the entire police force out from the amount of noise they were making. I accepted it as any artist accepts tribute. The board was behind the elevator shaft where I had left it, a little weather-stained but still strong. A few seconds to carry it to the edge of the parapet and reach it across to the next building. Gently, this was the one dangerous spot where speed didn't count. Carefully onto the end of the board, the suitcase held against my chest to keep my center of gravity over the board. One step at a time, a 1,000-foot drop to the ground. If you don't look down, you can't fall. Over. Time for speed. The board behind the parapet. If they didn't see it at first, my trail would be covered for a while at least. 10 fast steps, and there was the door to the stairwell. It opened easily, and it better have. I had put enough oil on the hinges. Once inside, I threw the bolt and took a long, deep breath. I wasn't out of it yet, but the worst part, where I ran the most risk, was past. 2 uninterrupted minutes here, and they would never find James Bolivar, alias Slippery Jim Degrees. The stairwell at the roof was a musty, badly lit cubicle that was never visited. I had checked it carefully a week before for phono and optic bugs, and it had been clear. The dust looked undisturbed, except for my own footprints. I had to take a chance that it hadn't been bugged since then. The calculated risk must be accepted in this business. Goodbye, James Degrees, weight 98 kilos, age about 45, thick in the middle and heavy in the jowls, a typical businessman whose picture graces the police files of 1,000 planets. Also his fingerprints. They went first. When you wear them, they feel like a second skin. A touch of solvent, though, and they peel off like a pair of transparent gloves. All my clothes next, and then the girdle in reverse. That lovely paunch that straps around my belly and holds 20 kilos of lead mixed with thermite. A quick wipe from the bottle of bleach, and my hair was its natural shade of brown. The eyebrows, too. The nose plugs and cheek pads hurt coming out, but that only lasts a second. Then the blue-eyed contact lenses. This process leaves me mother naked, and I always feel as if I have been born again. In a sense, it is true. I had become a new man. 20 kilos lighter, 10 years younger, and with a completely different description.
After being put on the case, solving the crime becomes a personal battle between himself and the beautiful but deadly Angelina, who is planning a coup of one of the feudal worlds. DeCreese's dilemma is whether he'll turn Angelina over to the Special Corps or join with her. The good nature, amazing dialogue, and fun story make this book a must listen to. And you can have The Stainless Steel Rat today. Here's what Audible has set up for us. They are offering a free audiobook and 30 days to give you the opportunity to check out their service. This includes free access to the Audible Plus catalog, which is updated monthly with new titles. To download your audiobook, go to audibletrial.com/Ron's Amazing Stories. Again, that's audibletrial.com/Ron's Amazing Stories, and you can get The Stainless Steel Rat today. Thank you, Audible. One of the very first books I read in my youth, from cover to cover, was The Stainless Steel Rat by Harry Harrison. Yes, the very same book you heard about in our Audible segment. I had the pleasure of sitting and chatting with Mr. Harrison at the world-famous Powell Books in Portland, Oregon. He was utterly fascinating and quite charming, very much like his character James Bolivar DeCreese, alias Slippery Jim, alias, of course, the Stainless Steel Rat. For those of you who may not be familiar with the character, James is a fictional anti-hero of a series of comic science fiction novels written by Harry Harrison. He is a futuristic con man, thief, and all-around rascal. He is charming and quick-witted. He is also a master of disguise, martial arts, an accomplished bank robber, a criminal mastermind, an expert on breaking and entering, and, perhaps most usefully, a very skilled liar. To say that I love these books, well, that truly is an understatement. This past week, I found a novella starring the Stainless Steel Rat that I had never heard before. It was quite shocking to hear one of my favorite characters return to the world of the living. You see, his creator, Harry Max Harrison, passed away on August 15, 2012. The work is titled The Misplaced Battleship and was originally published in the April 1960 issue of Astounding Science Fiction. Now here's the cool part. The story loosely images the plot of Book 1, The Stainless Steel Rat, that you heard the clip from. This work, however, was never copyrighted, and that means that I can share it with you today. What you will hear is parts 1 and 2 on this podcast, and we will conclude the story next week. In this classic adventure, it might seem a little careless to lose track of something as big as a battleship, but interstellar space is on a different scale of magnitude. But still, a misplaced battleship in the wrong hands? Well, that can be pretty dangerous. Here is The Misplaced Battleship, read for us by our old friend Phil Chenevert.
Chapter 1 of The Misplaced Battleship by Harry Harrison. When it comes to picking locks and cracking safes, I admit to no master. The door to Inskip's private quarters had an old-fashioned tumbler drum that was easier to pick than my teeth. I must have gone through that door without breaking step. Quiet as I was, though, Inskip still heard me. The light came on, and there he was, sitting up in bed, pointing a 75 caliber recoilless at my sternum. "You should have more brains than that, DeGriz," he snarled, "creeping into my room at night. You could have been shot." "No, I couldn't," I told him as he stowed the cannon back under his pillow. A man with a curiosity bump as big as yours will always talk first and shoot later. And besides, none of this pussyfooting around in the dark would be necessary if your screen was open and I could have got a call through. Inskip yawned and poured himself a glass of water from the dispenser unit above the bed. Just because I head the Special Corps doesn't mean that I am the Special Corps, he said moistly while he drained the glass. I have to sleep sometime. My screen is open only for emergency calls, not for every agent who needs his hand held. Meaning I am in the hand-holding category? I asked with as much sweetness as I could. Put yourself in any category you please, he grumbled as he slumped down in the bed. And also put yourself out into the hall and see me tomorrow during working hours. He was at my mercy, really. He wanted sleep so much, and he was going to be wide awake so very soon. Do you know what this is? I asked him, poking a large glossy pick under his long broken nose. One eye opened slowly. Big warship of some kind. Looks like Empire lines. Now, for the last time, go away, he said. A very good guess for this late at night, I told him cheerily. It is a late Empire battleship of the Warlord class. Undoubtedly one of the most truly efficient engines of destruction ever manufactured. Over a half mile of defensive screens and armament that could probably turn any fleet existent today into fine radioactive ash, except for the fact that the last one was broken up for scrap over 1,000 years ago, he mumbled. I leaned over and put my lips close to his ear, so there would be no chance of misunderstanding. Speaking softly but clearly, true, true, I said, but wouldn't you be just a little bit interested if I was to tell you that one is being built today? Oh, it was beautiful to watch. The covers went one way and Inskip went the other. In a single unfolding, in a concerted motion, he left the horizontal and recumbent and stood tensely vertical against the wall, examining the pick of the battleship under the light. He apparently did not believe in pajama bottoms, and it hurt me to see the goosebumps rising on those thin shanks. But if the legs were thin, the voice was more than full enough to make up for the difference. "Talk, blast you, DeGrizz, talk!" he roared. "What is this nonsense about a battleship? Who's building it?" I had my nail file out and was touching up a cuticle, holding it out for inspection before I said anything. From the corner of my eye, I could see him getting purple about the face, but he kept quiet. I savored my small moment of power. "Put DeGrizz in charge of the record room for a while," you said. "That way he can learn the ropes." Burrowing around in century-old dusty files will be just the thing for a free spirit like Slippery Jim DeGrizz. Teach him discipline. Show him what the Corps stands for. At the same time, it will get the records in shape. They have been needing reorganization for quite a while." Inskip opened his mouth, made a choking noise, then closed it. He undoubtedly realized that any interruption would only lengthen my explanation, not shorten it. I smiled and nodded at his decision, then continued. "So you thought you had me safely out of the way, breaking my spirit under the guise of giving me a little background in the Corps' activities. In this sense, your plan failed. Something else happened instead. I nosed through the files and found them most interesting, particularly the C&M setup, the categorizer and memory. That building full of machinery that takes in and digests news and reports from all the planets in the galaxy, indexes it to every category it can possibly relate, then files it. Great machine to work with. I had it digging out spaceship info for me, something I've always been interested in." "You should be," Inskip interrupted rudely. "You've stolen enough of them in your time." I gave him a hurt look and went on slowly. "I won't bore you with all the details since you seem impatient, but eventually I turned up this plan." He had it out of my fingers before it cleared my wallet.
"What are you getting at?"
he mumbled as he ran his eyes over the blueprints. "This is an ordinary heavy cargo and passenger job. It's no more a warlord battleship than I am." It is hard to curl your lips with contempt and talk at the same time, but I succeeded. "Of course, you don't expect them to file warship plans with the League Registry, do you? But as I said, I know more than a little bit about ships. It seemed to me this thing was just too big for the use intended. Enough old ships are fuel wasters. You don't have to build new ones to do that." This started me thinking, and I punched for a complete list of ships that size that had been constructed in the past. You can imagine my surprise when, after 3 minutes of groaning, the C&M only produced 6. One was built for self-sustaining colony attempt at the second galaxy. For all we know, she is still on the way. The other 5 were all D-class colonizers built during the expansion when large populations were moved. Too big to be practical now. I was still teased as I had no idea what a ship this large could be used for, so I removed the time interlock on the C&M and let it pick around through the entire history of space to see if it could find a comparison. It sure did. Right at the golden age of Empire expansion, the giant warlord battleships. The machine even found a blueprint for me. Inskip grabbed again and began comparing the 2 prints. I leaned over his shoulder and pointed out the interesting parts. "Notice, if the engine room specs are changed slightly to include this cargo hold, there is plenty of room for the brutes needed. This superstructure, obviously just tacked onto the plans, gets thrown away and turrets take its place. The hulls are identical. A change here, a shift there, and the stodgy freighter becomes the fast battle wagon. These changes could be made during construction, then plans filed. By the time anyone in the League found out what was being built, the ship would be finished and launched. Of course, this could all be coincidence. The plans of a newly built ship agreeing to 6 places with those of a ship built 1,000 years ago. But if you think so, I will give you 100-to-1 odds you are wrong, any size bet you name." I wasn't winning any sucker bets that night. Inskip had led just as crooked a youth as I had, and needed no help in smelling a fishy deal. While he pulled on his clothes, he shot questions at me. "And the name of this peace-loving planet that is building this bad memory from the past?" "Citanuvo, second planet of a B-star in Corona Borealis. No other colonized planets in the system." "Never heard of it," Inskip said as we took the private drop chute to his office, which may be a good or a bad sign. "Wouldn't be the first time trouble came from some out-of-the-way spot I never even knew existed." With the automatic disregard for others of the truly dedicated, he pressed the scramble button on his desk. Very quickly, sleepy-eyed clerks and assistants were bringing files and records. We went through them together. Modesty prevented me from speaking first, but I had a very short wait before Inskip reached the same conclusion I had. He hurled a folder the length of the room and scowled out at the harsh dawn light. "The more I look at this thing," he said, "the fishier it gets. This planet seems to have no possible motive or use for a battleship, but they are building one. That I will swear on a stack of 1,000 credit notes as high as this building. Yet, what will they do with it when they have it built? They have an expanding culture, no unemployment, a surplus of heavy metals, and ready markets for all they produce. No hereditary enemies, feuds, or the like. If it wasn't for this battleship thing, I would call them an ideal League planet. I have to know more about them." "I've already called the spaceport. In your name, of course," I told him. "Ordered a fast courier ship. I'll leave within the hour." "Aren't you getting a little ahead of yourself, DeGriz?" he said, voice chill as the ice cap. "I still give the orders, and I'll tell you when you're ready for an independent command." I was sweetness and light, because a lot depended on his decision. "Just trying to help, Chief. Get things ready in case you wanted more info. And this isn't really an operation, just a reconnaissance. I can do that as well as any of the experienced operators. and it may give me the experience I need so that someday I, too, will be qualified to join the ranks. All right, he said. Stop shoveling it on while I can still breathe. Get out there, find out what is going on, then get back. Nothing else. And that's an order. By the way he said it, I knew he thought there was little chance of it happening that way. Since my forced induction into the Corps 6 months earlier, I had been stuck on this super-secret planetar that was its headquarters and main base. I had very little sitting-down patience anyway, and it had been long since exhausted. It had been interesting at first, particularly since up until the time I was drafted into the Special Corps, I wasn't even certain it really existed. It was too much like a con man's nightmare to be real. A secret worry. After a few happy years of successful crime, you begin to wonder how long it will last. Planetary police are all pushovers, and you start to feel you can go on forever if they're your only competition. What about the League, though? Don't they take any interest in crime? Just about that time, you hear your first rumor of the Special Corps, and it fits the bad dreams. A shadowy, powerful group that slips silently between the stars, ready to bring the interstellar lawbreaker low. Sounds like TV drama stuff. I had been quite surprised to find they really existed. I was even more surprised when I joined them. Of course, there was a little pressure at the time. I had the alternate choice of instant death, but I still think it was a wise move. Under the motto, "Set a thief to catch one," the Corps supposedly made good use of men like myself to get rid of the more antisocial types that infest the universe. This was still all hearsay to me. I had been pulled into headquarters and given routine administrative work for training. 6 months of this had me slightly gaga, and I wanted out. Since no one seemed to be in a hurry to give me an assignment, I had found one for myself. I had no idea what would come of it, but I also had no intention of returning until the job was done. A quick stop at supply and record sections gave me everything I needed. The sun was barely clear of the horizon when the silver needle of my ship lifted in the gray field, then blasted into space. The trip took only a few days, more than enough to memorize everything I needed to know about Cittanuvo, and the more I knew, the less I understood their need for a battleship. It didn't fit. Cittanuvo was a secondary settlement out of the Selene system, and I had run into these settlements before. They were all united in a loose alliance and bickered a lot among themselves, but it never came to blows. If anything, they shared a universal abhorrence of war, yet they were secretly building a battleship. Since I was only chasing my tail with this line of thought, I put it out of my mind and worked on some tri-D chess problems. This filled the time until Cittanuvo blinked into the bow screen. One of my most effective mottos has always been, secrecy can be an obviousity, what the magicians call misdirection. Let people very obviously see what you want them to see, then they'll never notice what is hidden. This is why I landed at midday on the largest field of the planet after a very showy approach. I was already dressed for my role and out of the ship before the landing braces stopped vibrating. Buckling the fur cape around my shoulders with the platinum clasp, I stamped down the ramp. The sturdy little M3 robot rumbled after me with my bags. Heading directly toward the main gate, I ignored the scurry of activity around the customs building. Only when a uniformed under-official of some kind ran over to me did I give the field any attention. Before he could talk, I did, foot in the door and stay on top. "Beautiful planet you have here, delightful climate, ideal spot for a country home. Friendly people, always willing to help strangers and all that, I imagine. That's what I like, makes me feel grateful. Very pleased to meet you. I am the Grand Duke Sant'Angelo." I shook his hand enthusiastically at this point, and let a 100-credit note slip into his palm. "Now," I added, "I wonder if you would ask the customs agents to look at my bags here. Don't want to waste time, do we? The ship is open. They can check that whenever they please. My manners, clothes, jewelry, The easy way I passed money around and the luxurious sheen of my bags could mean only one thing. There was little that was worth smuggling into or out of Cittanuvo. Certainly nothing a rich man would be interested in. The official murmured something with a smile, spoke a few words into his phone, and the job was done. A small wave of custom men hung stickers on my luggage, peeked into one or two for conformity's sake, and waved me through. I shook hands all around, a rustling hand clasp, of course, then was on my way. A cab was summoned, a hotel suggested. I nodded agreement and settled back while the robot loaded the bags about me. Chapter 2 of The Misplaced Battleship by Harry Harrison. The ship was completely clean. Everything I might need for the job was in my luggage. Some of it quite lethal and explosive and very embarrassing if it was discovered in my bags. In the safety of my hotel suite, I made a change of clothes and personality after the robot had checked the room for bugs. And very nice gadgets, too, these core robots. It looked and acted like a moron M3 all the time. It was anything but. The brain was as good as any other robot brain I have known, plus the fact that the chunky body was crammed with devices and machines of varying use. It chugged slowly around the room, moving my bags and laying out my kit, and all the time following a careful route that covered every inch of the suite. When it had finished, it stopped and called the all-clear. All rooms checked. Result negative, except for one optic bug in that wall. Should you be pointing like that? I asked the robot. Might make some people suspicious, you know. Impossible, the robot said with mechanical surety. I brushed against it, and it is now unserviceable. With this assurance, I pulled off my flashy clothes and slipped into the midnight black dress uniform of an admiral in the League Grand Fleet. It came complete with decorations, gold bullion, and all the necessary documents. I thought it a little showy myself, but it was just the thing to make the right impression in Cittanuvo. Like many other planets, this one was uniform conscious. Delivery boys, street cleaners, clerks, all had to have characteristic uniforms, much prestige attached to them, and my black dress outfit should rate as high as any uniform in the galaxy. A long cloak would conceal the uniform while I left the hotel, but the gold-encrusted helmet and a briefcase of papers were a problem. I had never explored all the possibilities of this pseudo-M3 robot. Perhaps it could be of help. "You there, short and chunky," I called. "Do you have any concealed compartments or drawers built into your steel hide? If so, let's see." For a second, I thought the robot had exploded. The thing had more drawers in it than a battery of cash registers. Big, small, flat, thin, they shot out on all sides. One held a gun and two more were stuffed with grenades. The rest were empty. I put the hat in one, the briefcase in another, and snapped my fingers. The drawers slid shut, and its metal hide was as smooth as ever. I pulled on a fancy sports cap, buckled the cape up tight, and was ready to go. The luggage was all booby-trapped and could defend itself. Guns, gas, poison, needles, the usual sort of thing. In the last resort, it would blow itself up. The M3 went down by a freight elevator. I used a back stairs, and we met in the street. Since it was still daylight, I didn't take a heli, but rented a ground car instead. We had a leisurely drive out into the country and reached President Ferraro's house after dark. As befitted the top official of a rich planet, the place was a mansion. But the security precautions were ludicrous, to say the least. I took myself and a 350-kilo robot through the guards and alarms without causing the slightest stir. President Ferraro, a bachelor, was eating his dinner. This gave me enough undisturbed time to reach his study. There was absolutely nothing. Nothing to do with wars or battleships, that is. If I had been interested in blackmail, I had enough evidence in my hand to support me for life. I was looking for something bigger than political corruption, however. When Ferraro rolled into his study after dinner, the room was dark. I heard him murmur something about the servants and fumble for the switch. Before he found it, the robot closed the door and turned on the lights. I sat behind his desk, all his personal papers before me, weighted down with a pistol, and as fierce a scowl as I could raise smeared across my face. Before he got over the shock, I snapped an order at him. "Come over here and sit down, quick." The robot hustled him across the room at the same time, so he had no choice except to obey. When he saw the papers on the desk, his eyes bulged and he just gurgled a little. Before he could recover, I threw a thick folder in front of him. "I am Admiral Thar, League Grand Fleet. These are my credentials. You had better check them." Since they were as good as any rear admiral's, I didn't worry in the slightest. Ferraro went through them as carefully as he could in his rattled state, even checking the seals under UV. It gave him time to regain a bit of control, and he used it to bluster. "What do you mean by entering my private quarters and burglaring?" "You're in very bad trouble," I said in as gloomy a voice as I could muster. Ferraro's tanned face went a dirty gray at my words. I pressed the advantage. "I am arresting you for conspiracy, extortion, theft, and whatever other charges developed after a careful review of these documents. Seize him." This last order was directed at the robot, who was well briefed in its role. It rumbled forward and locked its hand around Ferraro's wrist, handcuff style. He barely noticed. "I can explain," he said desperately. "Everything can be explained. There is no need to make such charges. I don't know what papers you have there, so I wouldn't attempt to say they are all forgeries. I have many enemies, you know. If the League knew the difficulties faced on a backward planet like this, that will be entirely enough," I snapped, cutting him off with a wave of my hand. "All those questions will be answered by a court at the proper time. There is only one question I want an answer to now. Why are you building that battleship?" The man was a great actor. His eyes opened wide, his jaw dropped. He sank back into the chair as if he had been tapped lightly with a hammer. When he managed to speak, the words were completely unnecessary. He had already registered every evidence of injured innocence. "What battleship?" he gasped. "The Warlord-class battleship that is being built at the Cinerentola Space Yards. Disguised behind these blueprints." I threw them across the desk to him and pointed to one corner. "Those are your initials authorizing construction?" Ferraro still had the baffled act going as he fumbled with the papers, examined the initials and such. I gave him plenty of time. He finally put them down, shaking his head. "I know nothing about any battleship. These are plans for a new cargo liner. Those are my initials. I recall putting them there." I phrased my question carefully, as I had him right where I wanted him now. "You deny any knowledge of the Warlord battleship that is being built from these modified plans?" "These are the plans for an ordinary passenger freighter. That is all I know." His words had the simple innocence of a young child's. Was he ever caught? I sat back with a relaxed sigh and lit a cigar. "Wouldn't you be interested in knowing something about that robot who was holding you?" I said. He looked down as if aware for the first time that the robot had been holding him by the wrist during the interview. "That is no ordinary robot. It has a number of interesting devices built into its fingertips. Thermocouples, galvanometers, things like that. While you talked, it registered your skin temperature, blood pressure, amount of perspiration and such. In other words, it is an efficient and fast-working lie detector. We will now hear all about your lies." Ferraro pulled away from the robot's hand as if it had been a poisonous snake. I blew a relaxed smoke ring. "Report," I said to the robot. "Has this man told any lies?" "Many," the robot said. "Exactly 74% of all statements he made were fake." "Very good," I nodded, throwing the last lock on my trap. That means he knows all about this battleship. The subject has no knowledge of the battleship, the robot said coldly. All of his statements concerning the construction of this ship were true. Now it was my turn for the gaping and eye-popping act, while Ferraro pulled himself together. He had no idea I wasn't interested in his other hanky-panky, but could tell I had had a low blow. It took an effort, but I managed to get my mind back into gear and consider the evidence. If President Ferraro didn't know about the battleship, he must have been taken in by the cover-up job, but if he wasn't responsible, who was? Some militaristic clique that meant to overthrow him and take power? I didn't know enough about the planet, so I enlisted Ferraro on my side. That was easy, even without the threat of exposure of the documents I had found in his files. Using their disclosure as a prod, I could have made him jump through hoops. It wasn't necessary. As soon as I showed him the different blueprints and explained the possibilities, he understood. If anything, he was more eager than I to find out who was using his administration as a cat's paw. By silent agreement, the documents were forgotten. We agreed that the next logical step would be the Cenerentola space yards. He had some idea of sniffing around quietly first, trying to get a line to his political opponents. I gave him to understand that the League, and the League Navy in particular, wanted to stop the construction of the battleship. After that, he could play his politics. With this point understood, he called his car and squadron of guards, and we made a parade to the shipyards. It was a 4-hour drive, and we made plans on the way down. The space yard manager was named Roca, and he was happily asleep when we arrived, but not for long. The parade of uniforms and guns in the middle of the night had him frightened into a state where he could hardly walk. I imagine he was as full of petty larceny as Ferraro. No innocent man could have looked so terror-stricken. Taking advantage of the situation, I latched my motorized lie detector onto him and began snapping the questions. Even before I had all the answers, I began to get the drift of things. They were a little frightening, too. The manager of the space yard that was building the ship had no idea of its true nature. Anyone with less self-esteem than myself, or who had led a more honest early life, might have doubted his own reasoning at that moment. I didn't. The ship on the ways still resembled a warship to 6 places, and knowing human nature the way I do, that was too much of a coincidence to expect. Occam's razor always points the way. If there are 2 choices to take, take the simpler. In this case, I chose the natural acquisitive instinct of man as opposed to blind chance and accident. Nevertheless, I put the theory to the test. Looking over the original blueprints again, the big superstructure hit my eye. In order to turn the ship into a warship, that would have to be one of the first things to go. Roca, I barked in what I hoped was authentic old space dog manner. Look at these plans. At this space-going front porch here. Is it still being built onto the ship? He shook his head at once and said, No, the plans were changed. We had to fit in some kind of new meteor-repelling gear for operating in the planetary debris belt. I flipped through my case and drew out a plan. Does your new gear look anything like this? I asked, throwing it across the table to him. He rubbed his jaw while he looked at it. Well, he said hesitatingly, I don't want to say for certain. After all, these details aren't in my department. I'm just responsible for final assembly, not unit work. But this surely looks like the thing they installed. Big thing, lots of power leads. It was a battleship, all right. No doubt of that now. I mentally reached around to pat myself on the back when the meaning of his words sank in. Installed? I shouted. Did you say installed? Roca collapsed away from my roar and gnawed his nails. Yes, he said. Not too long ago. I remember there was some trouble. And what else? I interrupted him. Cold moisture was beginning to collect along my spine now. The drives, controls, are they in too? Why, yes, he said. How did you know? The normal scheduling was changed around. causing a great deal of unnecessary trouble. The cold sweat was now a running river of fear. I was beginning to have the feeling that I had been missing the boat all along the line. The original estimated date of completion was nearly a year away, but there was no real reason why that couldn't be changed, too. "Cars! Guns!" I bellowed. "To the space yard! If that ship is anywhere near completion, we are in big, big trouble." All the board guards had a great time with the sirens, lights, accelerators on the floor, and that sort of thing. We blasted a screaming hole through the night, right to the space yard and through the gate. It didn't make any difference. We were still too late. A uniformed watchman frantically waved to us, and the whole convoy jerked to a stop. The ship was gone. Rocha couldn't believe it. Neither could the president. They wandered up and down the empty ways where it had been built. I just crunched down in the back of the car, chewing my cigar to pieces, and cursing myself for being a fool. I had missed the obvious fact, being carried away by the thought of a planetary government building a warship. The government was involved, for sure, but only as a pawn. No little planet-bound military mind could have dreamed up as big a scheme as this. I smelled a rat, a stainless steel one. Someone who operated the way I had done before my conversion. Now that the rodent was well out of the bag, I knew just where to look and had a pretty good idea of what I would find. Rocha, the spaceyard manager, had staggered back and was pulling at his hair, cursing and crying at the same time. President Ferraro had his gun out and was staring at it grimly. It was hard to tell if he was thinking of murder or suicide. I didn't care which. All he had to worry about was the next election, when the voters and the political competition would carve him up for losing the ship. My troubles were a little bigger. I had to find the battleship before it blasted its way across the galaxy. "Rocha," I shouted, "get into the car. I want to see your records, all your records, and I want to see them right now." He climbed wearily in and had directed the driver before he fully realized what was happening. Blinking at the sickly light of dawn brought him slowly back to reality. "But, Admiral, the hour. Everyone will be asleep." I just growled, but it was enough. Rocha caught the idea from my expression and grabbed the car phone. The office doors were open when we got there. Normally, I cursed the paper tangles of bureaucracy, but this was one time when I blessed them all. These people had it down to a fine science. Not a rivet fell, but that its fall was noted in quadruplicate, and later followed up with a memo, rivet wastage query. The facts I needed were all neatly tucked away in their paper catacombs. All I had to do was sniff them out. I didn't try to look for first causes. This would have taken too long. Instead, I concentrated my attention on the recent modifications, like the gun turret, that would quickly give me a trail to the guilty parties. Once the clerks understood what I had in mind, they hurled themselves into their work, urged on by the fires of patriotism and the burning voices of their superiors. All I had to do was suggest a line of search, and the relevant documents would begin appearing at once. Bit by bit, a pattern started to emerge, a delicate webwork of forgery, bribery, chicanery, and falsehood. It could only have been conceived by a mind as brilliantly crooked as my own. I chewed my lip with jealousy. Like all great ideas, this one was basically simple. A party, or parties unknown, had neatly warped the ship construction program to their own ends. Undoubtedly, they had started the program for the giant transport. That would have to be checked later. And once the program was underway, it had been guided with a skill that bordered on genius. Orders were originated in many places, passed on, changed and shuffled. I painfully traced each one to its source. Many times the source was a forgery. Some changes seemed to be unexplainable, until I noticed the officers in question had a temporary secretary while their normal assistants were ill. All the girls had food poisoning, a regular epidemic, it seemed. Each of them, in turn, had been replaced by the same girl. She stayed just long enough in each position to see that the battleship plan moved forward one more notch. The girl was obviously the assistant to the mastermind who originated the scheme. He sat in the center of the plot, like a spider on its web, pulling the strings that set things into motion. My first thought that a gang was involved proved wrong. All my secondary suspects turned out to be simple forgeries, not individuals. In the few cases where forgery wasn't adequate, my mysterious ex had apparently hired himself to do the job. X himself had the permanent job of assistant engineering designer. One by one, the untangled threads ran to his office. He also had a secretary whose illnesses coincided with her employment in other offices. When I straightened up from my desk, the ache in my back stabbed like a hot wire. I swallowed a painkiller and looked around at my drooping, slack-eyed assistants who had shared the sleepless 72-hour task. They sat or slumped against the furniture, waiting for my conclusions. Even President Ferraro was there, his hair looking scraggly where he had pulled out handfuls. "You found them, the criminal ring?" he asked, his fingers groping over his scalp for a fresh hold. "I have found them, yes," I said hoarsely, "but not a criminal ring. An inspired master criminal, who apparently has more executive ability in one earlobe than all your bribe-bloated bureaucrats and his female assistant. They pulled the entire job by themselves. His name, or undoubtedly pseudoname, is Pepe Nero. The girl is called Angelina." "Arrest them at once! Guards! Guards!" Ferraro's voice died away as he ran out of the room. I talked to his vanishing back. "That is just what we intend to do, but it's a little difficult at the moment, since they are the ones who not only built the battleship, but undoubtedly stole it as well. It was fully automated, so no crew is necessary." "What do you plan to do?" one of the clerks asked. "I shall do nothing," I told him with the snapped precision of an old space dog. "The League fleet is already closing in on the Renegades, and you will be informed of the capture. Thank you for your assistance."
Well, did you fall in love with James Bolivar DeGreece? How could you not? Be sure to come back next week for the 33-minute conclusion of The Misplaced Battleship. I guarantee that you will not be disappointed. Thank you for listening.
The big red letters stand for the Jell-O family. Oh, the big red letters stand for the Jell-O family. That's Jell-O.
Yum, yum, yum.
Jell-O pudding.
Yum, yum, yum.
Jell-O tap. The Elka pudding's just the real.
That was episode number 466. You probably noticed that there were no These Are Your Stories this time. That was because of the length of our featured story, The Misplaced Battleship, which will conclude on next week's podcast. These Are Your Stories will also return next week. If you want to follow the podcast or the blog, just head to ronsamazingstories.com. There you will find all the links. Do you want to help the show? The best thing you can do is to tell your friends all about it, and please leave reviews or feedback wherever you listen. Clicking that follow or like button makes us grow. Thank you for listening, and I hope you come again to find out what are Ron's Amazing Stories.